especially important to take into consideration as this show is about urban affairs that, for one, can be discussing these same unceded territories. Today I'm here with Zainab and later Professor Preeti Narayan. Zainab, how are you today? How do we know each other? And I suppose the question I'm like making central to the show and all the guests I bring along is, what is your relationship with urban affairs?
Thank you so much for having me, Cillian. I am so excited to be here. We know each other from a myriad of places. I feel we always bump into each other in like cool spaces and then just became friends through that, which is like so magical and the best thing ever. And in terms of urban affairs, I think I am a human geography student, mm-hmm. so academically I deal a lot with the urban in my current degree.
But
I think also just like the relationship between people and place has always been interesting to me, and I love talking to people about their relationships with place. So super excited for our chat today.
Me too. Yeah, no, Zainab is a geography student major, so I was like, this is perfect. Also, all the work you do is like related to urban affairs.
Yeah, a lot of random organizing. My job as well mm-hmm. is just always dealing with like how people experience place. So
yeah. Lovely. Well, this is our little introduction. We're going to take a short break and be back with Professor Preeti Narayan, who will speak with us on urban commons, moral claims on space, how feminist and community approaches are critical to urban geography, and more. Honestly, I think Zainab and I just really like Preeti, who has allowed us to call her Preeti, by the way, and her research. So we're just here to have like a conversation about her research, how urbanization exists in like non-state mandated context, and more and more, and super exciting chat.
MRG Live is happy to present Anomaly with his live band at the Wise Hall on Saturday, February 24th, with support from Blue Wednesday. Anomaly has toured his electro jazz project all over the world, but this February, the Montreal-based artist embarks on a full Canadian tour for the very first time. Come out to experience the innovative fusion of electronic beats, jazz harmonies, and funky grooves from the one and only Anomaly, live in concert with his band. Don't miss Anomaly at the Wise Hall in Vancouver on February 24th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
It's Nardwar, the human serviette, and you're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM at doo-doo-loo-doo, doo-doo.
We have been called the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Hosted by the Indigenous Collective of CITR 101.9 FM, Unceded Airwaves unveils the hidden pages of Indigenous history and contemporary existence. Collective meetings are hosted on Thursdays at 6 p.m. in the lower atrium of the Nest CITR station, with a remote option as well. We are back and looking for passionate folks to contribute to the process of putting together our weekly radio show. Our community centers Indigenous joy, excellence, and current issues. Friends and allies are welcome. No experience is necessary. Come learn with us. Our Instagram is Unceded Airwaves, and that's the best way to keep up with us. If you're interested in getting involved or you have any questions, email me, indigenouscollective@citr.ca.
Okay. And we're back. Hello, hello. You are listening to Familiar Strangers broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 FM. We're here with Celine.
Zainab.
Preeti.
And we're here to have a conversation. Yeah. would you like to introduce yourself? We already did like a sort of introduction, but...
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Hi, I am Preeti Narayan. I am assistant professor in the Department of Geography at UBC. I also direct the Center for India and South Asia Research on campus.
So cool.
So cool.
Yeah, we were just talking about earlier how we're just so excited to talk to you. I've taken two of Preeti's classes, and they were just life-changing, so I'm excited to have the opportunity to chat.
Yeah, no, when I was first talking to Zainab, it was about your classes. When I was talking to Zainab about this show, it was also about your classes. And when I was just talking to Zainab about her future, it was also about, like, oh, it was like, oh, Preeti's research is so amazing. I'm kidding. Well, sort of kidding, but not really. Yeah. So we're kind of here to just talk about your research, about anything that feels interesting about your research, which is everything. But
you're all very sweet. Thank you. And yeah, I mean, having Zainab in my class was amazing. And I think we're all interested in very similar things, given that this podcast is about, you know, social infrastructure. You know, the minute you said that, I was like, boom, like that's what I do in a sense, a little bit. Yeah. So I'm really excited to talk to you about it.
Lovely. Would you like to explain your research a bit more? What you're looking at right now, what you've done in the past?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So maybe a little bit about my research is that maybe I'll start with my background, and I think that would explain a little bit about my approach to research. I've had the greatest opportunity, and you know, just find myself so fortunate to have been working with urban grassroots movements in Chennai, India, for a long time. You know, these are groups that organize around housing and tenure security, particularly around preserving a place for the urban poor in the central city. And this is a really important, issue to mobilize around in the face of large-scale slum evictions that characterize many cities in the global south.
Mm-hmm.
These huge sort of development projects, including, you know, think about big roads and bridges and expressways and malls and so forth that are emerging in urban landscapes in the global south, are threatening directly the lands on which people have lived for mm-hmm. many decades, right? So these projects have a direct impact on where people who've been living off of public lands for decades can now live. So what happens is that they are forcefully removed from the city and relocated in the peripheries. And the peripheral housing projects have a lot of issues, right? In the sense of being really far away from where people go to work, where kids go to school, where you need to go to get good healthcare and so forth. And so it is in this sort of landscape of large-scale dispossession that a lot of urban social movements and other groups are doing really important work in Chennai. I am now primarily associated with Pennurimai Iyakam, which translates to Women's Rights Movement, a 40-year-old movement in the city of Chennai, but not just in Chennai. They also work in Madurai and are allied with unions that organize at a much broader scale. And so a lot of my learning comes from there, and I think a lot of my teaching and research is informed by that. In my dissertation project that I finished a few years ago, mm-hmm. I studied how it is that urban residents were negotiating with these various actors, right, with bureaucrats and politicians and activists in order to secure their place in the city. And this is the work that I'm writing out of now, primarily. But there's other things that I'm interested in, which are all related, in my opinion. I'm really interested in thinking about what would it be for economic geography to be a public endeavor, right? Mm-hmm. Where we can acknowledge that expertise comes not just from academics who sit in the ivory towers and tell us how to think about the world, but from
right.
folks like unions mm-hmm. who have a critique of the economy, who are comprised of people who go to work and have comments to make about whether the economy works for them or not, what needs to be fixed about it, and so forth. And it's because of the efforts of labor movements that that the working classes in, say, you know, Tamil Nadu, which is the state that Chennai is in, and Chennai is what I study, therefore I will comment on that, have they've been able to mobilize around increased welfare benefits and get access to state resources in a way that they didn't before. And it was because they knew what they had to ask for. They had a comment. They had a critique of the economy, so to speak, and what labor needed in order to relieve themselves of some degree of precarity, right? And so I'm really interested in thinking about, you know, what does it mean to think about expertise? Who are we talking to? Who are other people who are talking and have important things to say? And how do we all engage with the economy? Because we're all economic actors, right? Mm-hmm. We all make economic decisions every day. And so this is something that I think about. And I don't think questions of, like, urban precarity are so distant from questions of knowledge production. Mm-hmm. Because the people who are, in fact, living in those conditions have things to teach everybody and to teach the rest of us. So we're in the beginning stages of thinking about what a public economic geography can look like. I'm also working on, we just got Shirk funding for doing an oral history project with my colleagues and comrades in the movement that I mentioned, Penurmayakam. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that the personal and professional histories of these women who've been organizing in the city can tell us the story of the city. Mm-hmm. And for this to be an archive of what the city used to be like, where it is now, and what social movements need to do for creating a more just Chennai. That's where I'm at. Sorry, long-winded answer to that.
No, that was amazing.
To that question that you asked.
I was so sucked into that.
Yeah, same. Yeah. I was just really thinking about this thing of, like, we talk about in geography quite often placemaking, but I've recently encountered this term of placekeeping, and what does it mean when a community is kind of working to retain the integrity of a space and kind of with their kind of informed perspective as people who live in that space and have that expertise, kind of generating a certain culture or trying to keep a certain culture or protect it in the face of neoliberalism, frankly, and like
dispossession.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, super, super cool.
I was like typing a little bit if there's clicking sounds. I'm gonna backtrack a little bit. How much time did you spend in Chennai?
So I was born and raised in Chennai, so pretty much. Mm-hmm. I lived for a few years in Kolkata as a child, but other than that, I went to journalism school. So I did undergrad and then went to journalism school there. And then I think started to be much so curious about the city. I used to, I don't know, maybe I tell the story in class. Do I tell you about bus day?
Yep.
So embarrassing and so dorky. Anyway, so I used to take myself on what I called bus days. Oh. Every now and then I would pick a Sunday. Actually, it was very often. It was actually most Sundays for a brief phase in my life where I used to take a bus from wherever I lived.
Yeah.
And then any bus I wanted, go wherever, get off wherever the hell I wanted, and then take the next bus, and then go wherever else I wanted, and so forth. Like, and this is how I used to explore the city on my own time. Like, it was just like, I was such a public transit nut, and I love the city, and this is what I used to do. And then as a journalism student that went to school in Chennai, we had to go out and look for stories all the time.
Right.
And it was all I did. I poked around in the auto parts, small industry part of town, in Chintadripet and in all of these places that my regular life wouldn't have taken me. So I think I've just been like a city girl for a very long time.
I love that.
Yeah, I love that
in this way. I know I tell this like really dorky story in my class. But so I've been thinking about the city for a long time. But honestly, it was only from about 2012 that I started to think about housing and tenure security specifically. And it was because I had a job as a researcher in a team called Transparent Chennai.
I was about to ask about that.
Yeah, this was a team. This was a research team that was housed within a larger research institute, and what it did was, I think we researched what we thought were understudied or neglected issues, mm-hmm. especially those concerning the urban poor. Like people right. weren't really talking about the so-called slums, mm-hmm. Their official status. Evictions were not part of like public discourse, really. They were just kind of happening. And so we thought it was our job to research what was happening. And we did this through, you know, policy research in a sense, but also a lot of community driven data collection and research on. You know, it went in both directions, right? On the one hand, kind of researching policy and sort of translating and communicating that to people, mm-hmm. to residents. And in the opposite direction, mm-hmm. of residents kind of being able to map and tell us what they need and then to kind of have that research find its way to government.
Right.
So we were kind of a conduit between government and urban residents in a sense, and did this through mapping and other kinds of research methods and outputs. And that's when I started to be really involved. And we did this work in collaboration with a whole host of community organizations, right. including Panoramaicam that I then became a member of.
Mm-hmm.
But these were groups that had been asking these questions, making the connections between land and labor, and urban citizenship for a long, long time.
Right, right.
And so, in a sense, asking what their research needs were, what kinds of public meetings, conversations, demonstrations, and protests we needed to have in order to raise attention to these issues. We did all of our learning from these community groups. I've been at it for a bit, I think.
Yeah.
But as part of and only learning from
yeah.
these veterans who've been doing it for decades, obviously. Absolutely. And with a team that was, you know, it was just a bunch of young people who woke up every day really passionate about thinking about the city a little
for
bit.
Sure.
And it was a really great time. Yeah.
Amazing.
So cool.
It is very cool. I guess you sort of answered this, but my question is like, how does like urbanization or like mapping out the city become a public endeavor? That's my question.
big question. Great question. How does it become public? I mean, I would argue that all residents of cities should give a damn about it. You
yes,
know. Sorry, am I allowed to say that?
Yes.
But I think we're all residents of the city, and we need to be concerned about what is it that happens in the city. We need to be cognizant not just of what is visible, but mm-hmm. also that which is invisible or being erased. I think those are important things
right.
for us to think about, right? And I think there's a certain necessity to connect our own everyday life and consumption practices to the impact that it has on the city, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And paying attention to how the city is changing in front of your own eyes. I think that's a great perspective that one gets from being a long-term resident of a
mm-hmm.
city, right? Like you don't remember the city in the same way. Like
yeah.
what it used to be when you were young is not what it is
for
today,
sure.
right? And it's in all of the small ways that starts to happen,
yeah.
right? And then you notice that the city has, in fact, changed. And so wondering how it has changed and what this means and who has gone missing, I think, and what kinds of urban forms are we seeing less of?
Mm-hmm.
How do people talk about other residents and other kinds of people in the city? I think these are all important things for us to care about. Does that kind of answer your question, maybe?
I think so.
For sure. Yeah, I'm just constantly also thinking about being entrenched in Vancouver's context.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking a lot about Stop the Sweeps and
mm-hmm.
kind of what's happening in the downtown
mm-hmm.
east side constantly right now, and is absolutely horrifying. But the wealth of knowledge of the city that
mm-hmm.
people who are experiencing that have and have been sharing in really cool ways that I've interacted with recently, I think is so emblematic of what you were talking about, of how urbanization is inherently a public domain, mm-hmm. but there is this kind of, yeah, there's like the state and hegemonic actors that kind of have a hand on it and mm-hmm. how we experience it mm-hmm. and kind of trick us into thinking that it's not about us when mm-hmm. it really is. So that's, yeah.
It's, I mean, I think in addition to being about us, it's also deeply political, right? Mm-hmm. We should care because there's stakes here, mm-hmm. right? There's stakes of citizenship, there's stakes of who belongs and who doesn't. Yep. And there's stakes around violence, there's stakes around the fact that the city often is kind to some and not to others. And we have to think about why that is the case. And any amount of, I think, political consciousness mm-hmm. should include a consciousness about your surroundings, but mm-hmm. also about the city, I think. Yeah.
I suppose that brings me to my next question, mm-hmm. Is like, and I emailed this to you, but I don't know. I'm still curious. is how does like one demographic, or like how does a demographic in the city become a political one rather than a civil one? And then how mm-hmm. are they then treated when mapping these like urban spaces out?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a few ways to approach that question. Mm-hmm. Firstly, I would say there's a lot of scholarship on Indian cities in particular that reflects on how mm-hmm. The middle class, the new middle class that gains a great degree of influence and significance after liberalization, after India opens up its borders to global capital in the early 90s, it ends up mobilizing the new middle class, so to speak, as mm-hmm. Leela Fernandez would call it, a class of people who are the primary sort of beneficiaries of mm-hmm. globalization, right? Yeah. They're in upwardly mobile service professions. They consume a lot of global products, right, that begin to find their way into the markets. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, over time, slowly you find the emergence of all kinds of new urban infrastructures and consumption spaces that are meant for them, mm-hmm. right? And that means then that you are automatically excluding or pricing out others from mm-hmm. participating in the same urban infrastructures, right? And so paying attention to how the city is changing mm-hmm. because of the influence of people from a particular class, right? And over time, and other scholars, including Asher Gertner, will tell you that this class also begins to take on significance in being able to determine not just their own urban outcomes, but also those of other people, right? Mm-hmm. Through buying into and propagating the idea of a global city, so to speak, right? Right. Like one that's like, yeah. Like swanky, fast, exactly, mm-hmm. right? Marked by huge infrastructure and world-class facilities and mm-hmm. so forth. What does that mean, right? Who is it for mm-hmm. and who is it not for, therefore? Mm-hmm. And who gets excluded and removed from the city in order to make room for these new infrastructures, right? This is how those belonging to a particular class also start to wield political power in a sense, right? Not just in an, not necessarily in an electoral sense, but being able to influence policy, judiciary decisions over time have changed and have become largely pro-middle class in a way that they weren't before, right? So we're talking about a large-scale kind of change in the media, in popular discourse, in the judiciary, in policy, and so forth, right? So this is one way of thinking about how the urban is political, mm-hmm. right? And there are people who are able to influence urban spaces and urban outcomes more than others. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes to the very nature of democracy. And this is true in most cities across the world, right? Mm-hmm. You'll find, the middle classes or business interests being able to dictate what the city looks like, what it needs to look like, and so forth. So I think there's some amount of commonality mm-hmm. In that sense. In India, it's complicated by questions of caste, where land ownership is concentrated mm-hmm. in the hands of the dominant caste folks. And so forth. So there's all kinds of axes to consider in terms of thinking about the city itself as sort of a political space, right, where some people gain and continue to gain more than others. But maybe another way to approach this question is, and maybe you got this from the paper, yes, is to think about the difference between civil society, mm-hmm, and political society. That's a framing been made, that it's quite an influential framing in a theoretical sense, forwarded by Partha Chatterjee, mm-hmm, who says, you know, in most post-colonial societies, you'll in fact find that there is a section of people who are able to relate to the state in terms of being citizens and having rights, right? One would argue that when you're citizens of a country, mm-hmm, in principle, we, yeah, all have the same rights, right? But if we think about whether we actually, in a substantive sense, have those rights, we can think about the right to livelihood, for instance. But there's lots of unemployed people, right? Mm-hmm. There's lots of people whom, due to the increased casualization of labor, find it really hard to find a job, right? Then what does that mean for your right to livelihood, for instance, for right? Sure. So that's just an example. So what, mm-hmm, I'm trying to say is that there are some who are able to relate to the state, mm-hmm, as citizens, right? Who are able to engage with the state in terms of legally enforceable rights, right? But there's also a whole big swath of the population who are citizens in an official, formal sort of sense, but who cannot or do not relate to the state on the same terms because, A, they're probably squatting on land that they, mm-hmm, do not own, and so forth, right? So then, So how do they relate to the state? So, right, that's one way of thinking about the divisions between civil society, mm-hmm, the former group, and the latter group, political society, mm-hmm, who, you know, in Chatterjee's conception, and we can talk about that if you're interested in a theoretical conversation, who are much more sort of subjects, right? Who are like, who have to be treated as populations, mm-hmm, whose survival needs to be ensured. So just, right, because they're squatting, you cannot allow them to die, in a, yeah, sense, right? You still have an obligation to preserve their life. Right. But how you do that is through sort of welfare mechanisms, mm-hmm, and so forth, where you ensure that a certain minimum degree of, you know, a certain minimum standard of a viable life is possible for you. And so the ways in which they would relate to the state is not by going to court,
yeah,
and saying, this property is mine, mm-hmm, someone's encroaching on it, like, help me. That's not going to happen. And law is often not something that works for them.
Yeah.
In some ways it does, and it used to much more than now. This is where, you know, my earlier comment about the judiciary becoming largely sort of apathetic to the concerns, right, of the urban poor sort of come in. That's probably an example. But how they work is through processes of sort of negotiation that are uneven, unpredictable. You can't always tell how, yeah, something's going to go. Protests, and so forth, and conversations and negotiations with bureaucrats are all examples of how they work with the state, mm-hmm, in order to get that kind of, mm-hmm, minimum standard of a viable life in the city.
Sure.
This is how one might imagine people living in so-called slums, right, mm-hmm, in these informal settlements in the city, are still able to put some kind of roof over their heads, get some access to water, access to a public toilet facility, and so forth. It happens through a mechanism that's, mm-hmm, not entirely legal, yeah, right? Chatterjee would call that a paralegal sort of system, right? Like that's that implicates state actors. They're very much involved in providing these services, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not on the basis of sort of individual property ownership-based logics. And so that's another way to think about political versus civil society.
I
need to talk a little bit less.
No, No.
This is the point. This is amazing. Like, I feel like you are answering all of my questions all at once. I think this is a good time to take a break.
Sure.
And then we'll be back because I think we should talk about more about, like, your research in Chennai. Mm-hmm. I do wonder, like, how did these women, like, navigate these, like, legal spheres and, you know?
That's also what I'm thinking about because of the, like, I'm thinking about the right to the city and, like, mm-hmm. how you just kind of, like, these women just grabbed it out of the fist of, like, a certain class mm-hmm. in such a cool way and, mm-hmm. like, what we can learn mm-hmm. from them, I guess. Yeah.
So we'll be back.
Cool.
After a short break.
Yeah. Cool.
Thank you, everyone.
For the first time ever in the Lower Mainland, Carrie Newman's The Witness Blanket is being exhibited at the West Van Library. The Witness Blanket is a large-scale art piece consisting of artifacts from sites and survivors of Canadian residential schools. For a self-guided tour of Newman's work, visit during regular hours from January 26th until March 10th, 2024. The West Van Library is open from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Friday through Sundays.
MRG Live is happy to present Anomaly with his live band at the Wise Hall on Saturday, February 24th, with support from Blue Wednesday. Anomaly has toured his electro jazz project all over the world, but this February, the Montreal-based artist embarks on a full Canadian tour for the very first time. Come out to experience the innovative fusion of electronic beats, jazz harmonies, and funky grooves from the one and only Anomaly, live in concert with his band. Don't miss Anomaly at the Wise Hall in Vancouver on February 24th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
Okay, so hello, hello. You are listening to Familiar Strangers broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 FM at the UBC Vancouver campus. We're here with Professor Priti Narayan talking about making the city a public endeavor, I suppose. I'm Celine, and this is Zainab. Yeah.
Yeah. I think just, like, carrying on from where we were talking a little bit about alternative ways to reclaim the city for people who don't necessarily benefit from the city in the same ways as certain classes or other identities. And I guess, yeah, just wondering a little bit more about the specific case of Chennai and mm-hmm. how women in particular have endeavored to reclaim their space and their right to the city in a sense.
Mm-hmm. So I think the word reclaiming is interesting. Mm-hmm. But before we come to the parts where we think about reclaiming, mm-hmm. I think maybe thinking about the parts, the ways in which the city has already been claimed, I think, would be an interesting start, right? Mm-hmm. And so to think about so-called slum settlements, which is what I study, if you think about the fact that, you know, slums have actually existed for a long, long time, right? They're an urban form that's existed for a long time, in a sense. You know, there has been varying capacities of the state, so to speak, you know, both the colonial state and mm-hmm. the post-colonial state, to provide housing for those who labored in the city, mm-hmm. right? Either in the factories or provided other kinds of labor, like, you know, lifting loads at the harbor and so forth, right? There has been, let's say, limited capacity from both state and capital in providing this housing. Mm-hmm. Therefore, people just made their own housing, right? They took up land, usually close to where they worked, and built out these entire neighborhoods together, right? And these have existed for a long, long time. And so what we see now being challenged is perfectly viable urban systems that are being threatened by new urban projects, mm-hmm. right, of the sort that I have described earlier in our conversation. Now, we shouldn't be romanticizing slums either, yeah. right? The state of precarity that people in informal settlements find themselves in, it's a legal gray area when you don't have rights to the land mm-hmm. that you live on. You're constantly in fear of being removed. Mm-hmm. That fear is much more heightened now than it ever was before. Mm-hmm. There were certain legal protections that allowed you to keep the land. Right. For instance, in Tamil Nadu, in the state of Tamil Nadu, there was legislation through which slums could be officially identified and declared to be protected from evictions, right? And you got a certain amount of, in addition to protection from evictions, some additional sort of urban privileges, even if you didn't own the land, right? You had, you got some kind of tenure over the land and the house that you had and so forth. And over time, we see that this kind of official declaration process that actually did protect you from evictions, that's not happened since the early 80s. I think 1984 was the last round of official slum declaration, right? Mm-hmm. That means that since the early 1980s then, people have been allowed to live in this legal limbo where you don't have official recognition. That means you can be evicted whenever, right? Without being given protections. And so there's a certain deliberateness to that, right? It's in order to help future projects in the city that one, I think that's how we should read the fact that slums haven't been declared in so long. And so I just want to say, like, these are perfectly viable, really innovative ways of living, but without romanticizing the fact that they have a degree of precarity associated with them. There have been many attempts to improve amenities in these settlements, some of which have happened incrementally over time, but you know that they could also do so much better. You know that they could also live without the threat of eviction.
For sure.
But it hasn't been optimal in a sense, right? And now there's the threat of more dispossession or more of a likelihood of you losing your home than before. And so I would say, in a sense then, that paying attention to the ways in which people have learned to create these really viable lives in the city is important, right? And I would argue, in a sense, that I know that I work with women, and a lot of my writing is around the ways in which women produce space. And we can get to the point of women more specifically in just a bit. I would argue that social reproduction, right, which is your ability to show up as labor in the city the next day, involves you having a roof over your head and cooking and cleaning and caring for your loved ones and your family and being cared for, in a sense. And then and having all of that in place is what allows you to show up as labor, really, okay, in the city, right? These are so we can think about slum neighborhoods as infrastructures of social reproduction, even care, right? Because this is a space of community and kin and kinship and so forth. And people are collectively involved in creating these neighborhoods, right? And so we need a sense of the fact that these are, in fact, neighborhoods, just like any other recognizable neighborhood is for you, right? It has streets, there's kids, there's facilities that the community uses that frequently people come together to create, right? So if they need a ration shop, meaning a place where you can access subsidized food and fuel from the state, people have put in the money to build their own ration shop when the state won't do it, right? Because they're illegal or informal and so forth, right? People come together and put in money and build their own childcare centers, right? Yeah. They run their own after-school education classes, right? And so these are all the things that make a place a neighborhood. And I think my research is really focused on bringing attention to the fact that these are, in fact, viable neighborhoods and really thriving in these ways. And secondly, the role of women is really important because the burdens of social reproduction have and do fall largely on women who are in charge of, you know, cooking, cleaning, caring for children and the elderly and so forth. And I found that there are some things about scholarship on, say, slum settlements that involve women simply negotiating space, right? Under the burdens of capital, patriarchy, whatever. But women also produce space, right? For instance, this childcare center that I have written about, the person who led in the construction was this really badass mason who was a woman, right? And all of the ways in which women of the settlement came together to plan the center, to raise funds for it, to oversee the construction of, to actually do the constructing of, and then later, once the childcare center was built, the women who became teachers and helpers in the facility, who decided what to feed the kids, what to teach them today, what the future of the center is going to be, and so forth, are all women, right? And so I think the ways in which women actually produce space, they are not just negotiating under these conditions of constraint, let's say, but are also actively producing space, I think is important and necessary. And the other thing is, I think these are lessons that I learned from the movement that I work with Pennurumayakam, is that, you know, before organizing in settlements used to be a very male-dominated affair. And over time, because of women's groups and because of the ability for these movements to think about questions of gender and land and labor together, that women are able to be decision makers and lead in thinking about initiatives in the city. And I would argue that women's issues are not separate from issues that have to do with the right to the city, right? Simply precisely because women are in charge largely of social reproduction. So if you, and I think this was an early learning of the movement, which was set up by a bunch of middle-class women who were like, we're going to fight for women's rights, right? And so for them, that involved organizing against domestic abuse, dowry debts at the time, and so forth. Those are all and still are very key issues, I would say. But the more they talked to working class women, they discovered that when you ask women what their problems were, they were like, look, my problem is that I don't have enough water to cook and care for my family. I don't have, I need electricity. I need a ration card so we can get fuel and food for the household and so forth. So this discovery, not really discovery really, but this need to admit that the right to the city was as much a woman's issue as was anything else. And so this is why women are so central to thinking about the city and who belongs and and what people deserve and so forth.
Yeah, I honestly, my next question was going to be like, why is there such a big need in like academia for there to be feminist scholarship on like urban geographies, and like, why must we take this lens? And it's precisely because of this, because women are excluded, or not excluded, but we talk about them as if they are separate from these political conversations, where again, everything is a political conversation, but you know what I mean.
The Marxist feminists, that's what they, that's what their project was, right? Like in thinking, in thinking about production and reproduction, really, they said, look, for labor to be reproduced, you need, there's this entire sphere of social reproduction that is under, that tends to be invisibilized, right? Or erased or not considered part of value generation and so forth. When in fact, if you didn't have that, laboring would not be possible at all, right? For, you know, processes of production to be in place even to start with. And so even in a theoretical sense, bringing attention to social reproduction and the fact that, you know, women are critical to accumulation because they bear much of the burden of social reproduction, I think is something that Marxist feminists, for instance, are very, very interested in emphasizing. And so absolutely, yeah. So I would say even, not just in a pragmatic sense, and so theory being like, look, here's this whole like side of reality that we need to contend with even more. But Marxist feminists have been doing this for decades.
Yeah.
But there's also so much room to think about what does this mean for the city, does this mean to think about the right to the city, and how do we imagine women as contributing to those visions. And how can we put social reproduction and care at the center of the questions of the right to the city, I think, are important.
We're running a little low on time. Okay. So I think we have one more question.
Yeah.
And that is, that this was Zainab's question, but we are, do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, just, I think there's such a wealth of knowledge here that isn't necessarily in mainstream discourse, especially in the global north and being situated in Vancouver in particular. So I guess I'm just wondering about how we can take all of these ideas of the roles of gender and class, and also just, yeah, how women in Chennai have kind of been so integral to creating that space and kind of informing this neighborhood of their own, and kind of how, what that tells us about Vancouver even, or what we can learn from that in our own context, I guess.
In our own neighborhoods.
Yeah.
I think that's a great question. I would say, you know, there are some things, unfortunately, about say the gender pay gap, or the erasure or the invisibilization of social reproduction and social reproductive process, and the undervaluing of care and care labor, that is true. It's kind of universal, right? Like the degree of, say, or the extent of, say, the gender pay gap could be different from country to country, but it does exist everywhere, right? So I think those are some broad things to think about across context, in a sense. But I think paying attention to, like I said earlier, how women do produce space, right? They are, in fact, agents of transformation and active production of space. I think those are some things to think about. I think COVID has really brought our attention to care labor and how undervalued that is. So we are in a moment where scholars and regular people are talking about care and care work a lot, and care professions do tend to be largely feminized, right? And there's also racial dimensions to who gets to do care labor, and so forth, and in this sort of international division of labor. So I think some of those conversations are already underway, and it's up to us to sort of begin to make the connections of questions of, you know, urban citizenship and belonging, and rights, in a sense. I would also say there are things to learn from the global north. It's not that squats don't happen here, for instance, right? But I think there are some theorists, including Ananya Roy, who have interesting things to, in a comparative sense, right? We keep thinking about the global north as somehow being more advanced than the global south, and more modern, and or having made more progress, being more developed, so to speak, right? And then you look at a neighborhood like the one that I described, and you're like, whoa, like that is really creative and innovative and smart and resourceful, right? And so I think it really makes you question those categories of like, what is developed, what is developing, what is an advanced economy and what isn't, and so forth. And you can also see the differences in the fact that even, you know, now this is a great, this is a context of great dispossession and so forth. But you think about the fact that these are, in fact, though, viable neighborhoods, even if they're precarious.
Yeah,
and you see the higher degree of criminalization, and the lower tolerance, frankly, for squats and tent cities and so forth in the global north. And you see that there is no room for that kind of democratic space where you may not be a legal participant in property markets, but you're still allowed a place in the city, right? Yep. And how those opportunities are, in fact, foreclosed in the global north. I think it really says something about, you know, democracy today and where we can learn from and what we can learn from. I think those are some really sort of interesting and fascinating questions for the nature of democracy even today. I would say, to use Aranya Roy's words or the words of her research participant, is to ask third world questions of the first world, in a sense. And I think so-called slum settlements allow us to do a lot of deep thinking about what our own cities are like. And given the housing crisis in Vancouver and the and just how expensive living here is, and especially housing in particular, right? So to think about, what does it mean? Like, how does this make us question access to housing and belonging and citizenship? I think would be really interesting.
Was gorgeous. that line, was it, we should asking third world questions in the first world context?
Of the first world,
The first world.
Yeah.
Wow.
How is it that we have homes over our roofs over our heads, and there are homeless people in America?
Yeah,
I think that's what the research participant asked Ananya Roy. Boom, right? Such a big moment. Yeah.
So good, yeah. I think I'm also just like, this whole conversation has got me excited because it really reflects how none of these experiences of the women in Chennai exist in like a silo or in a way that is
isolated,
like divorced from the story of Vancouver even, but even the rest of India or the rest of like the global south. Like, there are so many connections that can be made from their story to ours, I guess. And I think that's like the coolest part of your research, is that like it's such a specific context, and that specificity is also everything because it tells us so much that we can then like draw back to our own lives. So
definitely, I think, you know, it's a cliche, but it's also true, like, we live in a deeply interconnected world. You think that life out there is just something else, and like that's unconnected to you, it's kind of exotic and distant, but it's really not, because we're all implicated in sort of global capitalism in very specific ways, right? Through an international racialized gender division of labor. Therefore, all our lives are so connected, from the clothes we wear and who makes these clothes and what conditions and what enables this and so forth. These are all really important questions to be asking, including care, like who cares for us and who cares for our kids and who cleans our homes or who are we able to hire? Where do they come from? What are their lives like, where they live and so forth? I think everything is, we're all connected.
It's all interconnected. Before we keep going, I do need to cut us off. But this has been so insightful. Thank you so much.
Aww.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time and your, I don't know, I just think the way you express things is also, like, I was so sucked in. Like,
me
I don't even
too.
Know where I am right now.
Like, oh, no. I was great. Listening and, like, wow, 40 minutes has passed. I feel like we've just been sitting here for, like, a minute or something.
Absolutely.
Aww. You guys are very kind, but also your questions were so great, and I love how curious you are. I think some of the responses were probably a little bit broad, but I'm hoping it gave you something. I don't know.
Absolutely.
Like, I had, what, like, 10 questions? I only had to ask two because, like, we got the answers for everything. Because
I wouldn't stop talking.
No, your answers were so rich.
Such rich, responses.
Yes.
Well, thank you. It was such a pleasure being here.
Thank you. This was Familiar Strangers with Celine, Zainab, and Dr. Narayan. If you would like to listen to more, we'll be back, not next Thursday, but the Thursday after that. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
Come on, fresh on the scene, just a young kid straight out the rubble, running from trouble and motivated by a dream. I'm moving clean, hustle for supreme, maintain the elevation and put on my team. What I look like, they're checking for me on the gram. I reveal the plan, no you can't take command. I've been ready for 'em. First impressions and new blessings, I'm rock steady. I got lessons from higher powers and heavy heavies. You'd understand if you got a bad, you could take a stand with your best man, looking for demand. I believe that, ain't nobody flex like me, the light king to bring what you can't unsee. The lightning before rain, I can guarantee I don't need the bad karma. Keep the dot com, the fake drama. You can roll